This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Fresh from their national security debate in Las Vegas last night, keep an eye out for several Republican candidates heading to New Hampshire now. Last night's event was intense as nine contenders on the main stage tried to show a jittery America how they'd keep the country safe from terrorist threats. There was also an earlier so-called undercard debate with four candidates who have less traction in national polls. Some of the themes from both events included the tools national security agencies should have to sniff out potential terrorists, how deeply America's military should re-engage in the Middle East, and the role of immigration reform, given heightened security concerns. Today in The Exchange, we recap last night's debate and hear candidates explaining their main ideas. Let's hear from you, too. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour. Dante Scala is here, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNH and a fellow at UNH's Carsey Institute. And Dante, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks very much.
Also with us, Wayne L'Esperance, Professor of Political Science at New England College and Director of the Center for Civic Engagement, which includes the New England College Polling Institute. And Wayne, welcome back to you, too.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
And also with us, Paul Steinhauser, Political Director and Anchor at NH1 News. And Paul, thank you for taking time out. We appreciate it.
Always fun joining you.
Well, all of you, the main theme, of course, was terrorism and national security. But Wayne L'Esperance, what were the key pieces of that broader picture, the key questions that kept coming out all night long?
Sure. I mean, so if we sort of sketch out all the different elements of that broader discussion, we talked a lot about ISIS. We certainly talked a lot about the appropriate role for the United States. There seemed to be a lot of agreement that what we're currently doing isn't working. By those candidates, whether or not there should be boots on the ground, there was some disagreement there. Discussion about how to best work with allies. The conversation about Donald Trump's statement about vis-a-vis Muslims came up quite a bit within the context of how do we encourage Muslim allies, Arab armies, to join us in a coalition if we're saying to them that they're not welcome here. But it went beyond that. We eventually got into discussions about immigration, the role that private sector, particularly tech companies, could play in helping us in dealing with the terrorist threat against the United States. So there were a whole host of things. Eventually, they got to discussion briefly about Iran and the nuclear weapons deal. And I'm sure many more that will come up over the course of the hour. It was a very far-reaching, I think, discussion on national security issues, and it really gave us, I think, an opportunity to get some depth from candidates on their positions on these issues.
Yeah, and there were some other things that came up too, Dante Scala. The whole idea that whether the Iraq war was part of the problem that we're seeing now in the Middle East, there's a national security question there, but also perhaps those comments aimed at Jeb Bush.
Yeah, Donald Trump made a blanket statement saying, you know, we've spent, I think he quoted $4 trillion in the Middle East. We've, you know, obviously sent forces over there, spend a better part of a decade in the Middle East. And for what, he said. There was no, you know, we weren't the winners of that. And it was not only directed at Jeb Bush, but also thinking about, you know, the future of Republican Party's foreign policy. And there was some real disagreement on the stage there about the limits of what U.S. intervention can do. Should we be trying to create democracies over there or just preserve national interests? Is it a good idea to keep dictators in power in the Middle East as opposed to promoting democracy? So there are some interesting disagreements that I think will emerge only more strongly as we go forward and we start to winnow down this field.
Well, and since we talked about that issue and what Donald Trump said about Iraq, kind of aiming it at Jeb Bush, let's hear what Donald Trump said.
we have done a tremendous disservice, not only to the Middle East, we've done a tremendous disservice to humanity. The people that have been killed, the people that have been wiped away, and for what? It's not like we had victory. It's a mess. The Middle East is totally destabilized, a total and complete mess. I wish we had the $4 trillion or $5 trillion. I wish it were spent right here in the United States on our schools, hospitals, roads, airports, and everything else that are all falling apart.
Wow, that is exactly what President Obama said.
Again, that's a cut from last night's debate in Las Vegas on national security, and that was Donald Trump criticizing the whole idea of going into Iraq in the first place under the last President Bush. And then, Dante Scull, you heard Carly Fiorina there at the end jumping in.
Yeah, Carly Fiorina said at the end, well, that sounds just like what Barack Obama said, and she's right. And I would say also there's not much difference between what Donald Trump just said and what Bernie Sanders might say about nation building at home versus, you know, foreign policy adventurism overseas. And that's what makes Donald Trump love him, hate him, such an interesting character, because sometimes he kind of defies ideology, because in that statement he sounded a bit like a moderate to liberal Democrat, not a hawkish conservative Republican.
Well, and Paul Steinhauser, debates are, of course, about substance and style. And I'd love your thoughts on just who kind of did a good job presenting him or herself last night, really sounding sort of presidential and clear on the issue.
Well, right off the bat, listen, let's be honest. CNN wanted a fight, and they got a fight last night. In fact, they got two fights. So let's talk about those fights, because that goes to your question. One of them was Donald Trump versus Jeb Bush. And this was a battle over competence, whether Donald Trump is competent to be president. Jeb Bush had his most energetic debate to date, no doubt about it. He was in Donald Trump's face three specific times throughout the debate, Donald Trump pushing back. I don't know. Maybe it was Donald Trump's weakest debate, I think. He didn't do himself any – maybe he didn't do any harm, but he definitely didn't do himself any favors, and he didn't have a great command of the issues, but he hasn't had that to date. Does it matter? Probably not. Donald Trump was the front runner and remains the front runner. You had a second fight, and this was the more interesting fight. You guys were talking about this. This was the two senators on the rise, Marco Rubio of Florida, Ted Cruz of Texas, and this was a battle over national security. This was a battle over immigration. This was a battle over policy. Both of them made their cases. I think Rubio may have had the upper hand. John Kasich definitely had a much more measured debate than he'd had last time. He didn't look too presidential last time. He was too anxious. He was too jumpy. Much more calm, much more even-handed performance by him. And Chris Christie, again, playing the role he played in the last couple of debates of the person basically being the Washington outsider, saying these senators, all they do is debate. I've been there. I've done it. He had a strong debate.
Chris Christie, again, talking about, look, I'm not a senator.
All they do
is
debate.
Debate club.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm a governor. I've done it. I was a prosecutor. How many times does he remind us he was a prosecutor during 9/11, right?
You know, other people have said this morning what Paul just said. Strong night for Marco Rubio, Wayne Lesperance. What do you think?
No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think Marco Rubio was in a few dust-ups last night, as Paul has said. He was treated like a front runner in some ways, and I thought he acquitted himself well. I think there was a moment around the immigration issue where he may have struggled a little bit. I think he was trying to really land some gloves on Ted Cruz, and I'm not sure that worked out so well. But overall, I thought his performance was very strong. One thing about Christie really quickly, I thought that Christie did very well last night, especially pivoting himself not as one of the senators. And certainly if it, you know, the style of somebody who can push back, the accountability of a governor, he emphasized all those points that I think a lot of folks wanted to hear.
Well, and I definitely want to talk about Chris Christie for sure and all the candidates. And we're going to play back clips from all of them this hour. Let's hear a little from Marco Rubio. This was a little bit later in the hour. A lot of people thought he had a strong beginning, but then he did start to get criticized for his work with the so-called Gang of Eight that worked on immigration reform. Let's hear Marco Rubio talking about whether he still supports a so-called path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants.
I am personally open. After all of that has happened, and after 10 years in that probationary status where all they have is a work permit, I personally am open to allowing people to apply for a green card. That may not be a majority position in my party, but that's down the road. You can't even begin that process until you prove to people, not just pass a law that says you're going to bring illegal immigration under control. You're going to have to do it and prove to people that it's working.
And again, we didn't play that whole clip, Dante Scala, but he talked quite at length about all the security measures he would put in place, all the requirements, the big fence, the many years waiting. But still, he did say, look, I know I may be out of step with some in my party, but I still do favor this path to immigration.
Yeah. And then Rubio went on to make the point that his nemesis, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who's been attracting very conservative voters, especially out in Iowa, that Ted Cruz himself has not ruled out allowing illegal immigrants to find a path to citizenship somewhere down the road. Now, Cruz rather vehemently denied this, but seemed to leave open a little bit of space. I think he used words such as, I don't intend to ever do this, which, you know, leaves a little bit of wiggle room. If Cruz and Rubio wind up being two of the last two standing or two of the last three standing, I think that'll be a very interesting set of debates, because both of them, I think, have proven themselves to be among the most consistently strong performers this entire year. But Rubio, as you mentioned, he faced the, according to 538.com, faced the most attacks, either confrontations or negative mentions, of all the Republicans. The only ones who got more negative mentions were Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. So,
which you would expect from a Republican debate. You know, Paul, it was interesting. At one point I was watching and I thought, gee, if I just tapped into this, I would think that Marco Rubio was the front runner. It was about 15 minutes and we hadn't heard from Donald Trump. In past debates, it's been, you know, one candidate, Trump, one candidate, Trump. He's been the center of attention. But there were big chunks of time last night where the camera was not on him. That was unusual for Mr. Trump.
It was. We did not see that in the first 3 to 4 debates. The dynamic is changing a little bit because, yes, Rubio, Cruz, are now on the rise, and they're going to get more attention, and they're going to get more pushback. Rubio kept firing back, though. You're right. Rand Paul and Ted Cruz tried to beat him up on immigration, but he did fire back, as Dante was just saying. He also pointed out that Cruz has suggested in the past massive increases in certain types of visas, which would allow a lot of, more immigration. So Rubio and Cruz, these guys are very good debaters. Cruz was a debater back at Harvard in his college days. Rubio is definitely a pro when it comes to this. And why does all this matter? Because debates matter. We've seen it the last couple cycles. They're so influential. This debate more than most, maybe, because there's not another debate for another month.
Wow. And the next debate is in New Hampshire, I think, Paul?
For the Republicans? Next Democratic debate is in New Hampshire this weekend. Next Republican debate, I believe, is in South Carolina in mid-January.
Okay.
So it's got a month to go.
Sure. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, especially if you watched last night's debate. We'd love to take your questions and comments, but also your questions and comments on this broader issue of terrorism and national security that was the issue on that stage last night. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's an email from Rob who says, I watched the entire debate, and while it may be difficult to tag one winner, for me there were two clear losers. CNN was the biggest loser, as their clear and repeated attempts to trap candidates such as Dr. Carson with gotcha questions were eventually jeered by the audience. Repeated attempts to get Trump and Cruz to tangle failed as well. Rob says also clearly fading is Jeb Bush. His only real tactic appeared to be attempting to look tough by interrupting Trump and trying to talk over him. He has become painful to watch and should get out. Rob, thank you for the comments. And Dante Scala, to you first. Let's talk about Jeb Bush and the struggles that he's had with this campaign.
Yeah, I would disagree a bit with Rob, although I agree with some of what he said. I thought Jeb Bush was, in fact, less painful to watch than he has been in previous debates. He seemed, especially during the first hour, where he seemed to be ready to confront Donald Trump, and he had some good one-liners, like you can't insult your way to the presidency, and he kept referring—
The chaos candidate.
The
That's
chaos
another one.
Candidate. Yeah. He kept referring to the fact that we need a serious candidate to be the Republican nominee, and Donald Trump was not it. Now, Bush kind of came and went during the course of the debate, but with regard to Trump and Cruz, though, I think Rob's absolutely right, is that Cruz and Trump, even though they're neck and neck in Iowa, showed no interest at all really in going at one another during last night's debate. And I think this is certainly part of Ted Cruz's strategy, is that he hopes that if Donald Trump somewhere down the road soon starts to fall apart and lose voters, that Cruz is going to be in a place to pick those people up. So neither one of them has much interest right now in going after the other.
Well, and that gets to what you and I talked about last week, Dante, your book, The Four Faces of the Republican Party, the fight for the 2016 nomination. So you're saying Trump and Cruz are kind of vying for the same slice. So Cruz is very carefully not trying to criticize Donald Trump so that if Trump starts to falter, he can pick up those people.
Yeah, Cruz. I mean, Trump, the interesting thing about Trump is he kind of defies these categories of ideology and so forth. But Cruz certainly hopes to pick up some of those voters, especially in places like Iowa and South Carolina.
Rob, thank you for the email. Go ahead, Wayne Lesperance.
I agree with Dante. I guess if I were a conspiracy theorist, I would say that Cruz and Trump had a conversation before the debate and worked this out because, I mean, at one point, you know, they sort of did a friendly, you know, guy bump thing or something on the stage. And so it was a little bit odd. I think a lot of folks thought there would be more of an exchange, but Cruz throughout has been very measured in what he has said. Even when CNN brought up the private conversation that where he was critical of Donald Trump, that did not engender a real fight. In fact, it engendered, you know, Trump afterwards in an interview saying, I appreciated his apology, which I'm not really sure he was an apology, but it was interesting how they managed that. I think Jeb Bush had the best night, I agree with Paul, of the debate cycle last night. Is it too little too late? I don't know. But the strategy that they used last night, trying to depict Donald Trump as not a serious candidate, is what he should have been doing 6 months ago. So we'll see if there's any effect. But that is the strategy, I think, that they should have employed a while ago. And we'll see if it's too little too late.
Well, and Paul, in a minute, I want to get your thoughts on the first part of Rob's email saying CNN was the biggest loser. But while we're talking about Jeb Bush, let's hear what he had to say, trying to, you know, depict himself as the serious candidate. Here he is responding to Wolf Blitzer's question. Governor Bush, you called Mr. Trump unhinged when he proposed banning non-American Muslims from the U.S. Wolf Blitzer asked, why is that unhinged? Let's hear.
Well, first of all, we need to destroy ISIS in the caliphate. That should be our objective. The refugee issue will be solved if we destroy ISIS there, which means we need to have a no-fly zone, safe zones there for refugees, and to build a military force. We need to embed our forces, our troops, inside the Iraqi military. We need to arm directly the Kurds. And all of that has to be done in concert with the Arab nations. And if we're going to ban all Muslims, how are we going to get them to be part of a coalition to destroy ISIS? The Kurds are the greatest fighting force and our strongest allies. They're Muslim.
Again, that's Jeb Bush in last night's Las Vegas debate. And gentlemen, we should talk about this a fair bit because this is a theme that spread throughout the whole night. This call, Paul Steinhauser, by Donald Trump to ban non-American Muslims from the U.S. How did you hear the other candidates responding to that, Paul?
You know, you were just talking about Ted Cruz, and this was interesting and telling. Ted Cruz is critical of what Donald Trump said and proposed, but he was criticizing it without really attacking Donald Trump last night. Some of the other candidates were very critical in attacking Donald Trump about that, especially Jeb Bush leading the way, saying it's going to make our fight against ISIS tougher. We heard the same thing from Lindsey Graham in the undercard debate. Once again, Donald Trump driving the conversation. He knows what he's doing. Ever since he mentioned banning Muslims 9 days ago at a speech in South Carolina, it's been the talk of the presidential campaign trail. Once again, Donald Trump right where he wants to be, the topic of conversation.
Well, and this idea of making the fight against ISIS tougher, Wayne Lesperance, because you can't upset our potential Muslim allies if you're doing this at home. So that was the point Jeb Bush tried to make. A couple other candidates tried to make that point too. Does it get through to voters, that idea?
I think it depends on the voter. I think the supporters of Donald Trump find that to be too nuanced an argument. At the end of the day, look, this is about blunt force trauma. Either we're going to go do something about it or we're not. Let's be real about the threat to the United States. And in their mind, that, you know, Trump's proposal is a response to a very real danger. You know, I thought, we haven't mentioned it yet, but I thought Lindsey Graham's apology, basically, on behalf of the Republican Party for that comment, I thought that was pretty powerful in the undercard debate.
You don't hear that a lot.
No.
That was pretty remarkable.
And I think, you know, frankly, Lindsey Graham, I think, did the best in both debates, frankly. But the other thing is the discussion about the fact, I think he said there are 3,500 Muslims in the United States military and that, you know, we ought to be honoring that service, not demeaning them or demonizing those folks. And this was his way of going after Donald Trump. I thought that was a rather smart way of attacking that particular policy.
All right. Dante, I know you want to jump in on that. We will go for that after a very short break. We'll hear from a lot more candidates. Let's hear from you, too. Your comments, questions, thoughts are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're recapping last night's GOP debate on terrorism and national security. We're digging into some of the issues raised, hearing some of the highlights from the debate, and let's hear from you, too. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. With me in studio, Paul Steinhauser, political director and anchor at NH1 News. Dante Scala, associate professor of political science at UNH. His forthcoming book is The Four Faces of the Republican Party, The Fight for the 2016 Presidential Nomination. Wayne Lesperance is also here, professor of political science at New England College and director of the Center for Civic Engagement. One more time, that exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Dante, just before the break, we were talking about how the other candidates responded to Donald Trump's controversial call to ban non-American Muslims from entering the country. I'd love to hear from you, too, on that, Dante.
Yeah, Jeb Bush did a nice job of dissecting what Donald Trump said and all the bluster and so forth and saying, well, you realize how counterproductive that would be to the larger purpose of defeating ISIS. And I thought that was his best – among his best moments last night is just calmly – but vigorously taking apart what Donald Trump had proposed. And it's interesting, there's a Bush's super PAC ally, Right to Rise, has been doing some door-to-door work in Manchester. And they're dropping door pieces like that hang on your doorknob. And the doorknob piece said, Jeb Bush, ready for battle. And it's interesting how they're trying to play the commander-in-chief card, saying this candidate, Jeb Bush, is ready for the national security challenges that face us. And it just shows how, in a month's time, how this whole campaign has shifted from more about the economy to national security. And that's for two reasons. One, obviously, because of the terrorist attacks in Paris and San Bernardino. But also, the economy is doing pretty well right now. I mean, Fed's talking about raising interest rates and so forth. The economy may not be the issue that Republicans hoped it would be just a few months ago. So all the more reason to double down on national security. And that is what Jeb Bush hopes is his Trump card, right, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Not a very good phrase to use in this campaign.
Not for him, no.
Yeah. So this this issue works for them, or they're hoping it works for
them. Well, they're hoping it works for them. And certainly, historically, Republicans tend to own the issue of national security and defense, although that faded somewhat in the wake of the Iraq War and so forth. But typically, Obama right now is not seen as strong on terrorism, according to the latest public opinion poll. So I think Republicans are hoping that their nominee will have an advantage in the general election.
Wayne?
It's a really important point that Dante makes. In the last few days, Jeb Bush's team has rolled out the number, and I forget the number, of admirals and generals that have come out in support for him, the number of Medal of Honor recipients that have come out in support for him. I think they're really looking for a 2008 in reverse kind of a moment where John McCain was sort of caught flat-footed, being a national security candidate, got flat-footed when everything really began to turn towards the economy. Financial crisis. I think the long ball strategy for Jeb Bush is that the country is really going to be looking for somebody who can be commander in chief, who's going to be a serious person who has ties to the national defense community. And that's where he wants to position himself. Everything I'm seeing from them is really emphasizing that point.
The problem is, though, Jeb Bush isn't the only one trying to do this.
That's right.
So is John Kasich. So is Marco Rubio. So is Chris Christie. So is Lindsey Graham. There's a lot of people in this camp. One of the most remarkable things about the debate last night, it was a national security debate. We don't even talk about the economy anymore. National security was a big issue going into this campaign. It is the only issue right now that matters, national security and dealing with terrorism here at home.
Dante.
You know, one place, to get back to Rob's point about CNN, I'm guessing Rob would disagree with me about this, but one point where I thought CNN fell down was there wasn't a single question about the climate change agreement that was just reached in a debate 2 hours on foreign policy and national security, et cetera. Not a single question from the moderators. Now, of course, Republican candidates are going to be reluctant to bring that up, but it was striking how 2 hours and not a single word and about a pretty important meeting that took place. Now, granted, people are focused more on ISIS right now, but that's certainly another topic that's on the minds of American voters.
Well, getting back to what you said, Wayne, about how, you know, it's tough for candidates. Sometimes the you enter a race thinking it's about the economy and then it switches to national security in 2008. We saw the opposite of that. Right. We thought it would be about Iraq and the Middle East, and instead it turned out to be about the economy, and candidates have to shift and adjust. I want to play a little bit of retired neurosurgeon and GOP presidential candidate Ben Carson. National security has been a tough issue for him. He is known more for his sort of strong moral values and strong faith, but he's been studying up on the issue, issued a 7-point plan in advance of the debate. Let's hear a little bit from Ben Carson last night, asked about his ISIS strategy.
Shut off the supply route, soften them up, then we go in with special ops followed by our Air Force to take them over. Those are things that work. But also, you know, this whole concept of boots on the ground, you know, we've got a phobia about boots on the ground. If our military experts say we need boots on the ground, we should put boots on the ground and recognize there will be boots on the ground and they'll be over here and they'll be their boots if we don't get them out of there now.
Their boots, meaning ISIS's boots here. Wayne L'Esperance, this was another interesting theme, and the candidates differed a lot in terms of the extent to which American military personnel should be physically there.
They really did. I think Ben Carson had sort of two tests last night. First was the substance. You know, could he talk about these things credibly? And the second thing was, you know, could he talk about these things credibly? Could he talk foreign policy in a way that people said, okay, he gets it, he understands it, he appreciates the subtleties and the complexities? And you know, I think I'll leave it to others to decide whether or not he did a good job with that. But yeah, I mean, we've heard from a number of candidates that if there is a need for U.S. military boots on the ground, then that's what we should do. From Lindsey Graham, who's ready to send over 100,000 folks or more, to Rand Paul, who's very reluctant to do anything that way, would much rather see Arab armies take this on. So there's a range of opinions in terms of dealing with it. But Ben Carson has crafted, I think, what is a little bit more of an aggressive approach to ISIS.
Dante?
It's striking how different standards will be applied to different candidates who are in the same race. I mean, and Ben Carson, now deservedly, has gotten scrutiny about how much he knows about foreign policy in the wake of Paris and the terrorist attacks and so forth, and has been seen to come up wanting in that regard. But then Donald Trump, who, Wayne, when he was asked about the nuclear triad,
right,
you know, about the array of nuclear weapons, he went 0-for-3, I believe. He couldn't even mention, you know, Rubio
had to explain it, remember?
Right.
And that was a smart move by Rubio. It really accentuated the point that that Donald Trump had no clue about
right.
this question.
It was really smart.
And yet Trump is so much about a tone, a rhetoric, an attitude that I think it does – he's been immune – to the scrutiny that always faces other more conventional candidates, even a Ben Carson who's seen his polls rise and fall. Trump says these things, and one would think, oh, that would doom another candidate. I mean, remember Rick Perry couldn't remember he forgot the third federal agency. Trump went 0-for-3, and it's probably not going to matter the day after.
But that's a great point you make, though, because Trump in many ways is the Teflon candidate. And why? Because you've got – his supporters are mad. They're angry at Washington. They're scared right now. And it's much more about optics, and it's much more about talking tough. It works.
But go ahead, Dante, and then we'll take a call.
But it'll be interesting to watch, and this is probably another reason why Trump doesn't get as much criticism from other candidates as you'd expect, is that he might be the definition of a high-floor, low-ceiling candidate. I mean, as you say, Paul, it's
– what does that mean, Dante?
That means that Trump voters are Trump voters no matter what. Like, we've all been waiting – for months and months, Trump will say these things and say, that'll be it. I don't know how many times I've thought that. This will be the straw that breaks the camel's back, and Trump voters will go away in droves, and yet they stay. So it's a high floor in that respect because Trump voters are going to be Trump voters. But
they're not going to fall out, in
right,
other words.
But it's a low ceiling in the sense that if you're not a Trump voter at this point, if you're a somewhat conservative Republican, you're not necessarily going to look and say, oh, Donald Trump, he's my man. And so I don't know that Trump's going to get a lot of converts from here forward. But I think there's a good chance that people who are Trump voters will likely stick with him no matter what he says.
That's why the establishment Republicans are so nervous.
That's right. And the other candidates would love to have that problem, right? They would love to have rock-solid support. Chris Christie on the campaign trail loves to tell this story about, I'm tired of being in your top three. It's time for me to be your number one choice. And they all get that. Oh, I really like so-and-so, but I'm not sure I'm ready to vote for them. Trump supporters are locked in. They'll defend him no matter what. If you followed social media last night, whenever a candidate criticized Trump, they were quick to push back. Doesn't matter. One fellow in New Hampshire is one of his, I think, state directors or co-directors, was critical of Lindsey Graham's military service. I mean, the one thing about Lindsey Graham is the guy served for 30 years in the service. I mean, we probably ought to honor that. Critical of it. And I'm thinking, really, that's an odd attack. But just because he was critical of Donald Trump. So his supporters are dialed in. They're very loyal. I don't think that they get peeled off. And I'm with Dante. I'm the same way. When he criticized John McCain, you know, said he was, I thought that's it. New Hampshire loves John McCain. That's going to kill him here. Nothing. Didn't ding him at all. So I think it's an important point that Dante makes, and the other candidates would love to have that problem.
And Paul? That high floor may be enough in a 14-candidate Republican right. field. Mitt Romney won 4 years ago with 37%. You're not going to need that this time around. 20% may do it.
Let's take a call, gentlemen. Again, the phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Mike is in Milford. Hi, Mike. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I don't understand. I watched the debate last night for about an hour and 15 minutes. And to be honest with you, it's kind of like watching, you know, another show form of entertainment for me, because I don't even know why it is even a debate. National security, citizens that are already in our country, we shouldn't even be debating it. If you're not in America, I don't know why we're worrying about who can and can't come in. We should be protecting who is here already.
Mike, are you referring to the fact that one of the San Bernardino killers was a citizen?
Yes, yes. Well, that would be part of it, absolutely. I'm sure there are citizens in the United States and abroad who are citizens that are not home that are part of, you know, some form of terrorist group. However, we can track them because they're citizens. So we have, our country is advanced enough where we know how to track our own citizens.
Well, however, actually, yeah. This is a really important point, Mike, and I'm glad you called. Okay, so the whole idea of, can we track people? Never mind, you know, people who may be coming in, as Mike says, but looking at the data, a lot of the mass shootings that we've seen, ISIS-inspired or not, have been committed by citizens, people already here. This was a big issue last night, guys, the idea of NSA surveillance and what we can and can't listen to. Wayne, I want your broad thoughts, and then we'll play some clips of some of the candidates talking about this.
Sure. And so there's a range of issues, right? Whether or not there's an appropriate or robust enough vetting process for folks coming into the country, whether or not there's an appropriate role for government, the NSA, to be monitoring conversations. I mean, this was something that I think Rand Paul spent a lot of time talking about last night as a constitutional issue. And on the other side, Huckabee and others arguing, well, what do you have to be afraid of if you're not doing anything wrong? You know, he made a vague comment about mosques. If they're not preaching hate, then there's nothing for them to be concerned about, something to that effect. So the variety of different issues came up around, you know, privacy and the constitutionality. But you know, on a very basic level, I think that most people can understand the fact that there's apparently Facebook chatter by one of the folks from San Bernardino. Had the government had the ability to find that, they might have been a little bit more predictive of the eventual outcome. You know, and it's much more complex than that. But when you're talking to voters in a 30-second clip and you say, look, they should be watching Facebook because this is where these conversations are happening.
Well, this has been an issue for Rand Paul and, as a lot of analysts have said, more salient for him about a year ago or so, Dante, right? Because Rand Paul got into this race saying, you know, on the whole Edward Snowden, and people were outraged, the government's listening. Now, a year or so later, that concern seems to have faded, and it's not been great for Rand Paul.
Yeah. I mean, I think the moment that that Rand Paul's father had in the Republican Party, when his father, of course, stressed kind of non-interventionism in the Middle East, that, you know, he had this famous exchange with Rudy Giuliani where back in 2007 in which he said, well, you know, the reason why there's terrorism is because of our intervention overseas. And, you know, and Rand Paul has been trying to follow in his father's footsteps. The problem is that Republicans have taken a decidedly hawkish interventionist direction. And in some ways, Rand Paul has, you know, succeeded in terms of legislation because of the, you know, the passage of the USA Freedom Act, for example, restricted the government's ability to collect phone data and so forth. So he's had some victories. But in terms of running for the president, running for commander-in-chief at a time when Republicans are concerned with national security, it's a tough ground on which for him to make the case, I could be your commander-in-chief, given his reluctance to commit U.S. troops and to get involved overseas.
Well, and that issue of the bill that you mentioned about, you know, bulk phone collection and how extensive that should be, that was a big issue between Senator Paul and Senator Rubio. Let's hear Kentucky U.S. Senator Rand Paul defending his position that increased surveillance will not improve security.
We are not any safer through the bulk collection of all Americans' records. In fact, I think we're less safe. We get so distracted by all of the information, we're not spending enough time getting specific information on terrorists. The other thing is the one thing that might have stopped Senator Bernardino, that might have stopped 9/11, would have been stricter controls on those who came here. And Marco has opposed at every point increased security, border security for those who come to our country. On his Gang of Eight bill, he would have liberalized immigration, but he did not, and he steadfastly opposed any new border security requirements for refugees or students.
Paul, what do you think about that clip, either in terms of, you know, what would keep us safer, better immigration policies or better surveillance? That seemed to be the debate there. Or that attempt by Rand Paul to sort of directly go after Marco Rubio. By the way, we didn't have time to play it, but at the end of that clip, he said, you know, Marco can't have it both ways. He can't be tough and yet be easy on immigration.
Yes, smart strategy here by Rand Paul, for sure, to go after Rubio and to say Gang of Eight. Anytime you can put a Republican and tie that Republican a Gang of Eight, not good. That doesn't sell well with Republican primary voters. Rand Paul was a rock star at the beginning of this cycle. He was going to be one of the front runners. He is far from that. He needed a strong debate performance last night. He got it. It may resuscitate him a little bit. Remember, his father came in a strong second year, 23-24%. Rand Paul in the state right now is in the low single digits. He succeeded in his mission last night.
Dante?
Getting back to Mike's point about, you know, debates and entertainment and so forth, and I guess I disagree a bit. I don't, you know, sure, there's entertainment value in these debates and there's ratings and CNN and company will glitz it up as much as possible. But I think as a whole, I think these debates have been positive things for the education of voters, not just in Iowa and New Hampshire, but nationally. Republican voters get to see these candidates up front. And, you know, for all the talk about nationalizing this whole nomination process, I think it's a better thing if candidates are being winnowed out because they're doing poorly in debates as opposed to, say, doing poorly in an Iowa straw poll, which is a ridiculous test for candidates and no way to winnow out candidates. Much better. At least we get to see candidates on the stage. And now, are there problems with the debate format and how they put people on one stage or another? Yes. But as a whole, I'd rather see this than some artificial event like an Iowa straw poll to winnow out candidates.
Well, and that was the thing about this focus, Wayne, on national security and terrorism last night, is that was the topic. So I think Dante's right. You did hear some depth on policy positions from these folks.
Oh, no, absolutely. I would completely agree. If you think about the campaign process, we're kind of in phase two at this point. The first phase is just kind of an introduction. Who am I? Where do I come from? Generally speaking, what are my values? And it's biography phase. We are at a phase now where we're expecting more substance, I hope. And we had an opportunity for that last night. And some of them came up wanting. Others really had an opportunity to push through and show off their chops.
All right. Well, and coming up, we'll hear more from other contenders, including Carly Fiorina and Chris Christie and John Kasich. Plus your questions and comments. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a recap of last night's Republican debate in Las Vegas, focusing almost entirely on terrorism and national security. Let's get your questions and comments in at 1-800-892-6477. Nine candidates took the main stage last night. There was also an earlier undercard debate of four candidates. Again, you can join us with your thoughts, questions, comments, concerns, 1-800-892-6477. 892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. My guests are Dante Scala of UNH, Paul Steinhauser with NH1 News, and Wayne Lesperance with New England College. And gentlemen, just before the break, we were talking about this idea of how much the government should be able to track what Americans are saying and doing online, on the phone, and so forth. And a couple candidates went back and forth on whether we should do more or less. We heard from Rand Paul saying increased surveillance hasn't made us safer. This was also an area where former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina jumped in a couple times, arguing that the government should rely more on help from the private sector in anti-terrorism efforts. Let's hear what Carly Fiorina had to say.
Why did we miss the San Bernardino couple? It wasn't because we had stopped collecting metadata. It was because, I think, as someone who comes from the technology world, we were using the wrong algorithms. This is a place where the private sector could be helpful because the government is woefully behind the technology curve. But secondly, the bureaucratic processes that have been in place since 9/11 are woefully inadequate as well. What do we now know? That DHS vets people by going into databases of known or suspected terrorists. And yet we also know that ISIS is recruiting people who are not in those databases.
Again, that's Carly Fiorina last night talking about better surveillance. And I wonder what you thought about that, Paul Steinhauser, you know, making the point that, you know, most parents are tracking their kids' activity on social media, and yet the government doesn't seem to be doing that.
We've heard a lot about this in the last couple of days since we found out that those Facebook postings were not ever looked at. It's been a huge talking point on the Republican side, and I can understand why. Ever since San Bernardino, that's all that's been on the minds of Americans, and especially that's all that's been on the minds of the presidential candidates. Carly Fiorina, good debater, hands down. She may not be resonating that strongly in the polls, but she can do well at a debate. She did not get a lot of time last night at the debate, but she made the most of her time.
Yeah, what do you think, Wayne? Carly Fiorina, on the face of it, you would think, okay, a former tech CEO wouldn't have a lot of foreign policy experience, but she has said repeatedly, I do have a lot of foreign policy experience, and has laid out a lot of details toward that end.
She has, and she's used it as a way to distinguish herself from Hillary Clinton, right? One of her lines on the stump is that I didn't just go for photo ops. I actually did work in these different places that I've traveled. I know Vladimir Putin. I know Benjamin Netanyahu, and I've worked with these folks. So, you know, she's played that up. I thought, you know, what she was saying last night was important, because here it is from the private sector perspective saying we are so out of date. The big theme here, by the way, is government isn't working for us. It's not working well for us. And from her point of view, there's so much the private sector could be contributing in a positive way to this war on terror that they're not doing, that they're not being asked to do, which is a failure of leadership, is a failure of government. This is part of her theme. So I thought, I agree with Paul, she didn't seem to have a lot of time, but when she did have a chance, she really stood out. And at times, she tried to break in. I mean, we played a cut earlier of her cutting into, I think it was Trump, it was something that Trump said about being
about
like Barack
the Iraq
Obama.
War. Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, she did well when she had the time, but I don't think I think she got overlooked quite a bit.
Although there was, in her answer to the role of tech companies and, you know, how much they should be helping, so to speak, Wolf Blitzer asked her, would you force them to hand over the records? And she said they should be asked. And I'm sure because of concerns of the clock, Mr. Blitzer didn't get the chance to say, okay, but what if you ask and they say no? So,
right. Yeah. And Carly Fiorina is an example of how, you know, despite all the talk that national debates are driving who the nominee is going to be, and they're certainly important, but they don't necessarily make or break a candidate, because Carly Fiorina is a candidate who at times has looked downright presidential on the stage with the other candidates, and yet she hasn't had a second act, so to speak. She's been her campaign to date has been unable to follow up on her strong debate performances because the resources aren't there. And so, unlike Donald Trump, who really succeeds not so much in debates but in the space between the debates, when the media is trying to find news to write about, they're always writing about Donald Trump. So he does better when there's nothing going on. Carly Fiorina, though, has the opposite problem. If there's no debate, people forget she's even out there, and you've seen her debate, her numbers in the polls slip because she's invisible when she's not on that debate stage, and that's a problem.
She's been in New Hampshire a couple times, Paul, right? Made a pretty vigorous effort here in the Granite State.
She's been a very frequent visitor here doing a lot of retail, and the super PAC supporting her has been very visible here as well.
All right, let's take another call, and Laura's in Hanover. Hi, Laura, go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I was, you know, it's disturbing to see how, as a nation, we've called on extremist Muslims, for example, to speak out and condemn Islam, you know, the radicals. And I find Trump, you know, an extremist among the candidates. And it was disturbing to see the only basically Governor Bush standing up to him and calling him out on it while the rest hid behind their podiums and avoided any kind of conflict with Trump. That is disturbing to me that someone leading the nation could just be quiet and not call him out on his hatred, his bigotry that's caused, you know, a lot of violent acts against innocent civilians in our nation.
So, Laura, it sounds like Jeb Bush's calling Trump out, as you put it, appeals to you.
I'm sorry?
It sounds like you appreciate that Bush did that, that you like that he did that.
Oh, yes, of course I do. Of course, because it takes courage. You know, Trump is a bully, and his rhetoric kind of, you know, it puts you off, and it could kind of make you back off a little bit. And he knew that was possibly coming, and he got, you know, right in his face and told him, and he said the truth.
All
but
right.
I found it disturbing that the rest of the candidates didn't do that.
Okay, Laura, thank you for calling. And Wayne Lesperance, I'll throw that to you.
So we're beginning to see a little bit more of that, right? So in the undercard debate, the first response that Lindsey Graham gave came with a Trump hit, and then everyone after him followed with some form of a hit on Trump.
Just give us a reminder of what that was, because the undercard debate was pretty early. I wasn't even home
sure.
yet. So.
It was a comment about Trump's comments about the ban on Muslims. And again, the theme was not being a serious policy. I think Jeb really led the way on this. There's an ad up right now by Kasich's Super PAC that is also critical of Trump. So we're seeing a little bit more of that. But I think Laura really hits on something that, and here's why. Candidates have been reluctant to go after Trump. The first one I think that went after Trump was Rick Perry. Scott Walker went after Trump. Where are those guys now?
Out.
And so for a lot of candidates, the strategy, and this has clearly been Ted Cruz's strategy, mixing it up with Trump doesn't yield good results. It doesn't seem to lead to more support for them. And so they've avoided it, I think. And that's where we are now.
And the flip side to that is Jeb Bush, who now realizes he was once the front runner. He's far from it now. His strategy now is to be the guy that hammers Donald Trump. And he did it last night. And what did it do? It gave him a lot of airtime, actually.
Well, here's an email about Donald Trump. This is from Christopher in Manchester. He says, I've noticed a certain trend in the media recently among pundits characterizing the Trump supporter, particularly in the wake of Trump's Muslim proposal. Ron Brownstein has repeatedly called them, quote, blue-collar Republicans, and a gal on NECN's Broadside condescendingly said 60% lack a college degree, thus the appeal of xenophobic politics, in her view. Christopher says, this is for you, Dante Scala, is that indeed the typical portrait of the Trump voter in New Hampshire? Christopher says, I believe his support is more widespread and that independents and affluent suburbanites in southern New Hampshire find him appealing as well. Christopher, thank you for the question. Dante?
Yeah, it's fair to say that even though, I mean, Trump support seems tilted toward blue-collar Republicans who lack a college degree. I think Trump gets more support among those folks and is more dominant among that group in the electorate than his competitors. But absolutely, he does get his fair share of college-educated Republicans. So there is something of a – he does bridge, you know, that – you know, different kind of socioeconomic groups, but there is a tilt definitely toward kind of more blue collar conservatives.
Well, and let's talk about someone else, gentlemen, who we haven't talked about that much, but Paul Steinhauser, at the beginning of the hour, you mentioned that you thought New Jersey Governor Chris Christie also had a good night. Just remind us what seemed to work for Governor Christie there on the stage.
We were talking about this briefly earlier. Christie made the point that, hey, I'm not part of that Senate debate club. I'm a governor and I get things done. And he was trying to be the realist and take the side of the voter. He's done that in past debates as well. Chris Christie is a very accomplished retail campaigner. He's a former prosecutor. He reminds us about that all the time. But also that means he's a good debater. He's good with the spoken language. He had another strong debate.
Yeah, what do you think, Wayne?
I agree. If you watch him on the campaign trail, I just saw him 2 weeks ago, I guess, at the Loudoun Firehouse. 500 people, it seemed, in the room. And he owned the room for almost 2.5 hours. And,
wow.
And he's really good on the stuff. That's his thing. I think he's great as a debater as well. And he really tried to carve out for himself his niche, you know, as a chief executive, as somebody who's held accountable by the people of New Jersey and as a tough guy.
Well, and that was definitely the theme we heard earlier in the debate. A little bit later, Chris Christie was asked whether he would be prepared to shoot down a Russian plane in that no-fly zone over Syria. Let's hear what Governor Christie said.
A no-fly zone means a no-fly zone. Wolf, that's what it means. See, maybe because I'm from New Jersey, I just have this kind of plain language hang-up, but I would make very clear, I would not talk to Vladimir Putin. In fact, I would talk to Vladimir Putin a lot. And I'd say to him, listen, Mr. President, there's a no-fly zone in Syria. You fly in, it applies to you. And yes, we would shoot down the planes of Russian pilots if, in fact, they were stupid enough to think that this president was the same feckless weakling that the president we have in the Oval Office is right now.
So, Dante, I'll throw this to you. You're from New Jersey, so there's some sort of tough straight talk from a New Jersey governor.
Yeah, it's remarkable how much better Chris Christie is doing than John Kasich in New Hampshire, despite the fact that John Kasich's record as governor of Ohio economically and so forth, it's much better than Chris Christie's is, which is decidedly mixed record in New Jersey, as any New Jerseyite would mention. But Christie has been so much better than Kasich at making the – really rounding out his case and saying, I have executive experience. And he's putting all his kind of eggs in that basket, that he can be that person. And Kasich has because his resume is so varied, or perhaps because there's a certain lack of discipline on message, he'll talk about not just being governor of Ohio, which I would think is his strongest point, but he'll talk about being on the Armed Services Committee of Congress 2 decades ago. So it's really – you get a very mixed bag with Kasich, whereas Christie is much more – he's got a path. If he can win New Hampshire – he graduates to that final round, and that's more than a lot of these candidates can say right now.
Well, and it gets back to what you said earlier, Wayne. When John Kasich got in, you know, people were more focused on wage inequality, right, you know, health care, the economy, and those were his strong suits. He said repeatedly, I'm governor of Ohio, and look at my sort of economic miracle. And now it's switching to foreign policy. And it's gotten a little tricky for Governor Kasich.
Well, that's right. We had him at New England College not too long after he got in. And it was all about the role he played in helping balance the budget and the economic success they've had in Ohio. It was clear that that was going to be the emphasis of the campaign. I think the sands have shifted a little bit under his feet. And he hasn't found, I think, a way to right himself again.
Well, here is Ohio Governor and Republican presidential candidate John Kasich weighing in on the Syria question. And whether or not America should be tougher on this issue of getting rid of Syrian President Assad.
I don't understand this thing about Assad. He has to go. Assad is aligned with Iran and Russia. The one thing we want to prevent is we want to prevent Iran being able to extend a Shia crescent all across the Middle East. Assad's got to go. And there are moderates there. There are moderates in Syria who we should be supporting. I do not support a civil war. I don't want to be policeman of the world, but we can't back off of this.
Policeman of the world, a recurring theme in many presidential debates that we've heard before. Also, Iran, Wayne L'Esperance, came up a couple times with people kind of tying that into this whole ISIS mess.
Right. So whether it's the discussion of the nuclear deal that the Republicans sort of roundly are critical of that the president's put together with Iran, or it's Iran's role in Syria and tying them to the Russians in support of Assad, Iran factored not as prominently as I thought they might. I thought there might have been a little more discussion about Iran and nuclear weapons and the folks in the region. But there was some discussion of Iran in that context.
Well, and we haven't heard yet from Senator Ted Cruz. He's the last candidate who we haven't played so far this hour. Here is Senator Ted Cruz describing his strategy for defeating ISIS. This is in response to a question again from the moderator asking Senator Cruz if he would carpet bomb Raqqa, the ISIS capital, where there are also a lot of civilians. Let's hear what Senator Cruz said.
To be clear, Senator Cruz, would you carpet bomb Raqqa, the ISIS capital, where there are a lot of civilians? Yes or no?
You would carpet bomb where ISIS is, not a city, but the location of the troops. You use air power directed, and you have embedded special forces to direct the air power. But the object isn't to level a city. The object is to kill the ISIS terrorists, to make it... Listen, ISIS is gaining strength because the perception is that they're winning, and President Obama fuels that perception. That will change when militants across the globe see that when you join ISIS, that you are giving up your life, you are signing your death warrant, and we need a president who is focused on defeating every single ISIS terrorist and protecting the homeland, which should be the first priority.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay, so a couple themes there. We don't have time to go into all of them. But very quickly, Wayne L'Esperance, how easy is it to sort of separate out the ISIS fighters from the civilians? I mean, are they
carpet bombing by definition
distinct.
Is indiscriminate, right? When we talk about – this is a really clumsy thing for him to have said multiple times, not just last night but before. It's indiscriminate. ISIS fighters are living in and among the population. You'd be killing tens of thousands of innocent civilians. So it's really a clumsy thing for him to have said and then to double down and repeat it. He should have rejected it, phrased it a different way. It's one thing to go after the ISIS fighters, but it's really an unrealistic notion to say, we're going to fly planes over, drop a lot of bombs, and hope they only kill the bad guys.
Dante?
Yeah, I mean, and this gets back to Laura's earlier point, though. I mean,
Laura the caller.
Republican voters are in an indiscriminate mood when it comes to the Middle East, when it comes to ISIS, and so forth. So even though I agree with Wayne's assessment, but Republican primary voters are in an indiscriminate mood.
Paul Steinhauser, here's an email I'm going to throw to you. This is from Mike in Springfield. Any chance of a Trump Rubio or a Trump Cruz ticket? Thanks, Mike, for the email.
You know, not out of maybe a Trump Cruz a little bit more than a Trump Rubio. You saw Trump and Cruz kind of make up last night after a couple days of a spat. Probably not a bad idea for Trump to have a running mate who knows something about Washington. The other big headline from last night's debate, Donald Trump declaring that, yeah, I'm going to run as a Republican, trying to put to bed any talk that he's brought up often about a third-party bid if he doesn't win the nomination.
Okay, and again, Paul, just to remind us of the next debates, the Democratic debate this coming Saturday.
Right here in New Hampshire. And then the next Republican debate, we've got a month away in mid-January in South Carolina.
Okay. Paul, thank you very much for being here. Always appreciate it.
Thank you.
Paul Steinhauser, political director and anchor at NH1 News. Wayne L'Esperance, great to see you.
Thanks, Laura. And happy holidays to you.
Wayne L'Esperance, professor of political science at New England College, director of the Center for Civic Engagement there. And Dante Scala, thank you again for being generous with your time.
You're welcome, Laura.
Dante Scala, associate professor of political science at UNH. His book is called The Four Faces of the Republican Party, The Fight for the 2016 Presidential Nomination. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Daniel Rosinski-Larson. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Laura Kanoy.